Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Julia.
My name is Felicia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diary series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
Jahanara, Princess of Princesses by Catherine Lasky. Summary. Beginning in 1627, Princess Jahanara, first daughter of Shah Jahan of India's Mughal dynasty, writes in her diary about political intrigues, weddings, battles, and other experiences of her life, includes historical notes on Jahanara's later life and on the Mughal Empire. Before we get started, we're going to have a bit of another version of the name problem, but instead of everyone having the exact same name, you have birth names, then you have one title, then you have another title, and everybody's getting called different names at different points.
Okay.
But to keep things simple, I'm just going to go and refer to people by the name / titles that they were best known for, and if needed, I'll give some context. If I'm quoting from somebody and they're referring to them as somebody, it's going to be pretty obvious.
Who they're talking about?
Exactly. So, but just as a bit of a heads up.
If I'm like, who dis? You'll say, who just talked about them.
Exactly.
All right.
To go to the book. So this book actually gets a chunk of the history wrong, and from what I can recall, has the most fudging. Let's use the words fudging. With historical people. I don't think it's a stretch to go and say that these books have their problematic elements.
But that's so easy to lay on everything, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, though, this book is probably the closest to the most, like, big P problematic book that we've had. And I think for more than one reason. But I don't want to go and make this whole episode about the good, the bad, and the ugly with this book. I'd rather go and focus on the history, but I think we'd be a bit remiss if we did not do some, at least a little bit of due diligence or have some discussion about how this book navigates certain topics, you know, religion, women, like a bunch of other different things. But before we go and get exact into all the history and stuff and all of that, what did you think about this book?
So I do remember that I read this one when it came out. Mm-hmm. I was still in the phase of I was collecting and reading the books. I didn't just transition to pure collection and not reading. We're coming up to that.
Oh, we're coming up to that very close and fast.
But I do remember reading this one. Can I say that it stood out to me? No. But I do remember that this was more of a jumping off point for me to do more personal research into the history of India around this time. And that sort of fluttered into further study that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But in terms of this actual book, it was really funny. When I was rereading this book, the first whatever entries in, and there's that whole ruse of her dad pretending to fake his death. Mm. I actually was like, he didn't die.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the F is this? And so then I quickly had to hop onto Wikipedia and was, this dude didn't die at this time. And then it was, he doesn't die. And I was, what is this book doing? So immediately my radar was just pinged. And then it was like, no, it's a ruse so they can get back to where they need to be and blah, blah, blah. So then I read the book and I vaguely remember this, but I feel like the big historical drama plot points, especially in her life, at least around this story of this family, is the fact that the dad loved the mother so much that when she died, he eventually created the Taj Mahal in her memory to be this beautiful tomb, and it's a testament to their love and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And that's totally just sort of at the very, very, very end-ish, mm-hmm. not even touched on. And so you're sort of gearing up to that sort of point in terms of her story in general. It was fine. I just felt like this time I was more cognizant of what the heck is she wearing a miniature of Elizabeth I around her neck for and being my heroine. When I grow up, I want to be like Elizabeth I. And I'm thinking, you know, your maternal aunt who's been cast as the villainess in this story.
In your words, the female Jafar.
The female Jafar in this book, actually, because she's alluded to as being a snake and stuff. So I'm just like, are you kidding me? She actually would be a peak role model person if you were, I want to be a ruler.
I want to do something different.
I want to do something outside the norm. Like, I'm going to be like Noura Khan. Or it could have been the flip side where she's
actually, really quick, she's referred to as Noura Mahal, but she's also known as Noura Khan, too.
That's the one. So anyways, if anything, it would have been more realistic for her to be like, I want to be strong like this woman, but she has such a bad reputation because she was this domineering person in force, and now she's the archenemy of my father who's trying to reign in his rifle, whatever. Anyways, none of that happens.
Yeah.
So it's very flat that way.
I mean, I think going and saying flat is a very accurate whole thing. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I remember the most about this book is it had amazing descriptions of everywhere that she was. We have a return of amazing food scenes. All of that type of deal. But I mean, in going and rereading this book came out in 2002. And because I am the way that I am, I don't know if people know what big geopolitical issues were happening in terms of how people were viewing Muslims at this point. Things were always like very like suspect. This isn't like a wholly negative look at Muslim people. And I appreciated that when I was younger. Because even as a kid, I do not think that like people who have been our neighbors and our family friends are bad people inherently.
No.
You know, so that was refreshing. But now that I'm older, I go and I reread, there are still is like a lot of Orientalist tropes. There still are a lot of holes in the research. It was productive for the time, but in hindsight, I don't know how productive it is right now.
Yeah, so this lady, she's the same. No, it's not the same one that wrote Cleopatra, but it vibes the same way with the exoticism of the East.
Yeah.
You know, everything's very mysterious. And then to your point, it is very much like, what is a good Muslim? AKA open, tolerant.
Anything not like those other ones who want to go
who are like more conservative or hardlined or
orthodox,
you know, orthodox in their belief in faith. It's how do you show yourself to be a good Muslim?
Yeah.
More we are the world sort of Muslim.
Yeah.
But we were talking about this, how most of the time when these books are written, especially when we're talking about the Western figures, it's very easy for someone to say, oh, I'm from the West and I'll just write about their beliefs and how they structure their life in their day the way I do. But religion wasn't just a side hobby or something that was your personal, I feel this is something I want to engage in belief. It was something that actually intersected with every single moment
of your life.
And so that doesn't necessarily come across. Actually, the best example of that coming across is our fave sad sack Isabel of Castile, and how her point of her diary is literally to demark how she has sinned and blah, blah, blah. And even though we made fun of it at the time, that's actually an accurate representation of how a lot of people enacted with their religious faith. That it wasn't just something, like I said, is a hobby. It actually dictated what they ate, what they wore, what they decided to do on the day-to-day basis. A lot of people don't have that same religious fervor. And so when you're writing these books, it really shows up in this weird way where you wouldn't know that this girl is of the Muslim faith. If anything, she's almost like the Christian equivalent of a chister, someone who goes to church on Christmas and Easter. She's like a chister version of a Muslim.
Well, and also too, is like, and then that's just so antithetical to who she was as a person, because she was deeply religious. She was very devout, not necessarily in the way how like some of her brothers were. Being Muslim is very important and central to who she was as a person. And this book doesn't go and do that, because of course we need to go and make her palatable and acceptable to young teenage middle school girls growing up in the wake of 9/11, where we are told that we are going to go and find the weapons of mass destruction and not be illegally invading Iraq.
You know,
Iraq,
a Sharia law is coming for us all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, so when it comes to this book, I'm like, it has a lot of problems. I'm not like the type of person who thinks that, oh, because you're like depicting something, that means you're condoning it, right?
Yeah.
It's like saying, oh, Toni Morrison goes and shows like racism in her books. She's condoning racism. No, she's clearly going and talking about her specific experience and trying to go and articulate it through the realm of fiction. Having something present doesn't mean a condoning of it or anything like that.
No.
But this book swings to the other way, though, in terms of actual problematic, where it's that we're going to really go and have a changing of how we're actually going to engage in not just who this person is, but we're going to go and totally go and just fall into these really negative stereotypes, too, as well.
Well, and I think also for the sake of narrative and unnecessary narrative, make up characters and situations that frankly didn't need to happen. And I think that's the other thing, too, where if someone is like super far in the past, like a Sondok or a Cleopatra, you're forgiven if you fudge the historical details. But like, you don't need to do that with her because it's not that far away. This is what, 1627?
We have records.
We have court records. Do the homework.
Exactly. I've gotten into my habit of sticky notes.
Julia's like, sticky notes strike again.
I mean, like, okay, just going forward, they're going to be sticky notes, fam. So my favorite, even as a child, no. I was like, no. Anyways, okay. So her father goes and gets an Armenian Christian concubine who did not actually exist. Alifar explained about the Christian God and his son, Jesus, who died on the cross for all people's sin. Even mine, I blurted out. Everybody seemed to think this is very funny and laughed. I hate it when people laugh like that at me. Was it such a stupid question? I mean, I am a Muslim. Would Jesus die for me? Then Amy sensed my embarrassment and said, Johnny, dear, I do not believe you have any sins. Well, this surprised me too. How would she know? Am I so simple I can have no sin or appear to have no sins? She doesn't know, I warrant, I have bad thoughts about Aurangzeb. I must conclude that if people believe I have no sins, I must be a very uninteresting person. She would know who Jesus was.
I mean,
she would freaking know who Jesus was and how he was taken up within the Christian faith. This is not an unknown thing. That's...
Maybe. I mean, look, I'm not going to say whether or not someone of a certain faith group does or doesn't know about other people's faith group figures and what the heck they did.
But Jesus is not an insignificant figure of Islam. Jesus is one of the main prophets because of his submission to God. This is not an unknown factor.
You never know what people know about different stories or not, depending on how much they pay attention to stuff.
The whole point is, though, is that that is just a clear moment of how do we go and we make this girl of a foreign faith more appealing?
Well, if anything, that whole exchange, which is totally fictitious, just seems to me like something out of a, are you there, God, summer camp, how do I come to Jesus type of moment, and where I'm just, is this book trying to convert people? What?
Probably.
Yeah. So that was a little odd.
Yeah. Oh, and also it's discussions of Hinduism in this book too as well. It's, oh, so we're not going to have any sort of nuance or discussion or going to any sort of...
They're Muslim, but apart from her complaining about having to participate in Ramadan without actually explaining
the significance
of it and what the meaning is behind it, which pretty sure they would have explained that to her.
Yes.
So she wouldn't be, I don't understand why we have to fast. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
That negates the whole purpose of fasting if you don't know why you're fasting.
Mm-hmm.
There is more time given to explaining about the different stories or at least the meanings behind Hinduism or Christianity than there is about Islam.
Yep.
I genuinely would have no clue about anything about Islam from this book, except for it turns you into a grouchy man baby.
Yeah.
Which is her brother.
Yeah.
And part of me is, man, what a missed opportunity. You could have talked about the pillars.
You have Ramadan. We're not going to go and talk like major in depth about what happens at two different types of Eids. Nothing like that.
None of those holidays or big festival things are ever touched on.
You get a vague passing when Abraham went and sacrificed his son. So you're not going to specify that he sacrifices Ishmael within the Islamic tradition and not Isaac. We're not going to, nothing, nothing.
Yeah, there's more time given to a Hindu wedding ceremony. And it's funny because she even says, I find the Hindu ceremony was more fun than the Islamic marriage ceremony. And I'm just thinking, well,
I wouldn't know. Me
as a reader, I wouldn't know because you haven't described it. So I guess I'll take your word for it. It must be boring to be married in a Muslim ceremony, according to you.
Yeah.
That's her personal take, I guess. Not.
Yeah.
Because it's fake and it's a fictitious person.
Ugh. Here's the thing, like, we could keep on going on and on about this book.
Yeah, can we get to real stuff now?
This book was disappointing.
It had so much potential.
It went flatter than a balloon. Yeah, that got the air let out of
it. And, like, in random times to do the jump forward, she would just...
I can't look at my diary right now.
I'm too upset.
Like, I was like, someone's been reading it.
I guess I won't write for a year. Okay, well, what's changed in a year that makes you think you can write now?
Exactly.
Like, get out of here.
Catherine Lasky really started strong. The Elizabeth book was well done.
Well, she set the tone for the whole book series.
And then the Mary Queen of Scots one was also like...
It was on the cusp.
It was like, okay. And then this one is just like, it borderlines being actively bad.
Well, it's... You know what it is the Elizabeth one, it was like on the two sides of this, historical fiction. Mm-hmm. That's what this book is. So the Elizabeth one had the historical and it had the fiction. The Mary Queen of Scots one, it had the historical-ish.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty okay. The fiction-wise, eh.
Yeah.
This one, it's really lacking in both sides. So I'm just, yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. But let's go and get to it.
Yay!
So, we are returning to the wheel.
What?
Shout out to the Marie Antoinette episode.
All right.
Oh, wow. So much enthusiasm right now. Anyways, but this is partially because developing an organizing principle always sucks. But also, we know, like, some things about, like, this woman as a person. Sometimes it's more interesting to go and talk about the stuff around this person that really shaped them.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the thing. She didn't leave behind a prolific amount of personal documents. She was not the subject of a major amount of court gossip or even much public gossip. She wasn't a scandalous figure.
Womp womp.
At least, like, from what I can see. She never married, and she couldn't get married, let's be real. And so the two main ways that women are remembered, usually within history, was either who did she get married to or what did she rule?
Mm.
Like, those are the two equations.
Or who did she give birth to?
Those aren't factors for her, because she never ruled, she never got married, she never had children.
Yeah.
Okay.
How do we talk about her then?
Exactly. I literally made a wheel.
Oh my gosh. So, Julia literally made a picker wheel so I can spin the wheel and figure out what are we going to talk about.
First.
Oh my gosh.
So, the categories are, wait for it, architecture, her siblings, the empire, religion, and her parents.
Okay. Spin, spin, spin.
I don't know if you want to go and do the...
Yeah,
that type of thing. The empire!
Yay!
So before we jump completely into an overview of the Mongol Empire, there are a lot of debates on how the empire operated. Was it a centralized and effective system? Was it a bit backwards? Was it this? Was it that? What were receptions? How do we go and define its rise, its collapse? There are different schools of thoughts. Some are a little bit more Marxist inspired in their interpretations. Some are more in terms of nationalists, like the current. Let's not go and get super into it, but like the current type of school of thought that's going on right now in the Indian subcontinent. There's a great overview of the historiography in The Princes of the Mughal Empire, 1504 to 1719 by Munisi Faruqi. And that's a book that I reference quite heavily. But anyways, I'm just going to go and give an overview of some of the dates, some of the facts, some of the figures that were significant to the Mughal Empire. Let's get started. Descending from the Iranian house of Timur, Zahir al-Din Muhammad Babur, better known today simply as Babur, reigned from 1526 to 1530, and he is considered to be the founder of the Mughal Empire. Babur was a Central Asian ruler who was descended on his dad's side from Timur, who was a Turco-Mongol conqueror who founded the Timurid Empire, and on his mom's side, he was descended from Genghis Khan. Oh. So this guy has like pretty great pedigree. He's not some random. But the main question is, so how do we get a guy from Central Asia and how does he end up in South Asia?
He got lost.
So Babur ascended the throne Ferghana in its capital Axikent in 1494 at the age of 12. I know, right? And immediately he had a lot of problems on his hands.
When you're 12 years old, leave him alone.
Exactly. But problems with various rebellions, people being like, dude, we don't need to listen to a 12-year-old.
Legit.
Yeah. He conquered Samarkand 2 years later, though. So he's 14. He's going into high school, and he's already taken over people. But he only lost Ferghana very soon after. So he's like, I won! But you lost your original thing. Eh, crap.
Yeah.
So in his attempt to reconquer Ferghana back, he lost control of Samarkand. So that pretty much left him with little money and nothing to rule.
Whamp, whamp.
So he turned his attentions to Kabul. Yes, that is Kabul, Afghanistan, where his uncle ruled but had recently died, leaving only an infant in charge, aka a bunch of ministers were chomping at the bit to go and take over. So Babur swooped in and settled in Kabul for the next 20 or so years.
Okay.
And in that time, he is modernizing the crap out of his army. He was also having a certain amount of conflict with other Uzbeks because he comes down from what's now like modern day Uzbekistan. He's still having conflict with his former relatives up there. Mm. And during this time, he recognized his ambition of wanting to expand Timur's original empire / take over the Punjab.
Fair enough.
So in 1526, Babur defeated the last ruler of the Lodi dynasty in a battle at Panipat, which is about 90 kilometers north of Delhi. The Lodis were one of the many short-lived Islamic houses that had ruled over much of the Indian subcontinent since the Islamic conquest of this area in 1192. So Babur and his successors, who continued to rule North India until 1858, were known as the Mughals. A term that Babur would not really have liked, for originally it had pejorative connotations.
Yeah, probably like the Mongols, like it's a slap back to his maternal side with Genghis Khan.
Well, and also it's like, here's the thing, on one hand, like Genghis Khan did go and have a massive empire like no one before or since, but there were a lot of negative connotations with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that there, another name for the empire, which is actually the name that was given quite colloquially, was Hindustan. Sometimes when I'm quoting people too in this, they go and they say Hindustan instead of the Mughal Empire. That's what it is.
Do they ever say the Punjab?
No.
Oh, I just remember it's like, take over the Punjab. That's all I know.
Everybody wants to go and take over the Punjab because it is a land of riches and it's gorgeous. But anyway, so he takes over, but he's only ruling for like a very short period of time.
Mm.
So, but following Babur was Humayun, who greatly expanded the empire again, but was also like his dad in that he had to retreat and come back a couple of times. In turn, he was succeeded by Akbar.
I know this guy.
How do we know this guy?
Because of the best Bollywood historical romance ever.
Jodha Akbar!
Jodha Akbar! It's so good. Don't even. Seriously, spend the 17 hours, it's not that long, of your life to watch at least the movie. It is so good.
It's a great film.
I'm just saying, if you have a rainy day Saturday afternoon, just
watch it.
Watch it. It's good.
All right, but anyway, so Akbar's reign was a turning point for the empire. He continued its expansion, but also encouraged unity amongst his people. He abolished sectarian taxes on non-Muslims, educational institutes were open to anyone of any faith, a library exclusively for women was built, and he made it possible for non-Muslims to gain favor and positions within the government. Also, I still think my favorite thing about Akbar was that we now, like, know that he was so dyslexic, he really could not read or write. But his challenges with literacy didn't stop him from loving and patronizing literature and the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an absolutely massive collection of scrolls and books of all these different languages. I just really love that about him, because I think some people who would be like, I can't do it. It has no value.
Yeah, I can't participate, so no one else can.
And he didn't have that attitude, and you know what? Good for him. I appreciate that.
It's a very healthy attitude.
Yeah. Anyways, so aside from that, we're going to go and get into more of the particulars about Shah Jahan's reign in the parent section and a little bit in the sibling section. He succeeded his father, Jahangir, and who had succeeded Akbar. And he basically achieved what Akbar was shooting for, which was the golden age stage in the Mughal Empire. Not just because of expansion, but because of his patronage of arts, culture, and architecture. But the empire really, though, got to its greatest extent under Aurangzeb. And the empire stretched from present-day Pakistan to present-day Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. North until Kashmir and south until like under Goa.
Wow.
It's absolutely massive. It was over 4 million square kilometers with tens of millions of people, 150 million people at its height, with hundreds of ethnic groups and religions. And unlike other empires, there was not like a complete assimilationist policy. It's a little shaky depending on who was in charge, but the emphasis on expanding the economy, trade, and modernizing the empire was central to pretty much everybody's agenda. Again, we're going to go and talk a little bit more about Shah Jahan and Aurangzeb's reigns a bit more specifically. So let's go and just like jump ahead to the collapse. So the empire, like any power, had its periods of conflict, expansion, but that such a massive and powerful empire basically imploded within a couple of decades is pretty mind-blowing. At the same time.
I mean, it feels like the industrialist and their booms and the big tycoon and I make all this money. And then by the time it gets to the grandson, it just like, what happened?
It has a similar type of vibe where within four generations, well, five generations, technically, everybody goes and forgets about, I already forgot, I was like, hey, man, whatever the frick his name was. I just said his name. I forgot it. That's the peak of it. We have a couple more generations where things are okay, and then it...
Yeah.
Really quickly.
What happened?
Exactly. So at this point, historians have accepted that the Mughal Empire proper, it ended with Muhammad Shah and the sacking of Delhi in 1739. He came to the throne in 1719, so that was seen as like the beginning of the end. But that sacking saw massive deaths. The royal coffers were emptied, and the peacock throne was taken to Persia. This massive blow, along with the encroaching East India Company, saw the end of the empire proper as it started to go and get folded into British control, and it had the kaputs when Queen Victoria was crowned Empress of India.
Yeah. If you need to reference, go back to our Queen Victoria episode and hear all about how she got her famous Kohinoor diamond, which is featured in this book.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to learn the fate of it.
Yeah.
Back reference to that episode.
The Mughal Empire was incredibly successful for a long time. The problem is that towards the end, cash flow started to go down. They started getting more fractured in terms of the military, and they couldn't go and compete with, it was a big banks thing too as well. In the end, it's not just because there was a crippling military defeat, but also literally the way how their economy was able to go and function was deeply impacted by the British Empire coming in along with their collaboration with different factions, basically went and caused a massive economic freeze and collapse. And if you don't have any money, you can't go and pay for your army, so then you can't freaking go and defend yourself, and then the cycle goes and continues.
And they didn't have any money because...
Pretty much the combination of changes in the way how the taxes were working, you're a factory owner and you are getting cotton in. Are you going to go and sell your money to the crown for not as much money? Or are you going to go and sell it to the Europeans?
Who
are going to go and pay you slightly more, but then also they'll go and import it back to you too in terms of textiles. Because at this point, the British textile industry hasn't actually fully boomed. Then when it starts to go and boom, then, oh, I can just go and sell my raw materials. I cut out the middle people, and then it goes and you pay even less tax then to the crown.
Yeah.
That type of deal.
Okay, so, like, basically the people who are in charge are getting cut out of the middle management deal, but that's probably because they didn't actually broker the stuff themselves properly. Or they tried to, but then it didn't matter because people were just going around them.
That's just one part of it. Like,
oh, it's a bunch of things. Always, there's always infighting. There's always divisions and factions. Look at how any empire collapses.
The Persian Empire, when it came down, they invaded too because they were pissed off because they didn't feel that they were getting adequate support. So that was a bit of a revenge plot too. And then there were rebellions with some of the other noble families and you have people in the south being like, I don't want to go and be part of this anymore.
And then British people are probably paying off and saying, hey, I know you're like a puppet kingdom person. Would you like to be a quote unquote independent kingdom?
Exactly.
We'll give you money so you can have money to rise up against this centralized government empire thing. It's a mess.
It is a mess. That's pretty much how it rose and how it fell. I just do find genuinely interesting is how it really was in the span a couple of centuries, which when we go and you think like there are some places where we've talked, they've been around for 900 years or they've been around for 500, 600 years. And it's just, wow. But truly it can just go and be a few things and then it all falls apart.
I think that's where we have a very short and long view of history. I think especially when you're reading about, you know, the summary of a place that it's on one page in your history book. Oh, the beginning of the end is on one page. That's 400 plus years that you've just read in one page.
Yep. Are you ready to spin the wheel?
Spin that wheel.
Spin the wheel. I've never watched Wheel of Fortune.
What?
So I have no idea how it actually works.
What's wrong with you?
Parents.
Yes. Let me tell you about this one true Bollywood love story.
Oh my God.
That should have been addressed in a different way in this book.
So, Jahanara's parents were Arjamand Banu Begum, better known as Mumtaz Mahal, the exalted one of the palace, and Shahab-ud-Din Muhammad Karam, better known as Shah Jahan, king of the world.
Can you imagine those on a license plate? The exalted one and the king of the world.
I mean, you know what? I love the energy.
I know.
Of
it's very much like that dress for the job that you want, not the job that you have.
Exactly. And they freaking did it. Ira Makoti, in her book, Daughters of the Sun, Empresses, Queens, and Begums of the Mongol Empire, writes that when the 15-year-old Karam Mirza, still known fondly to his father as Baba Karam, became engaged to the 14-year-old Arjuman Banu Begum in Lahore in 1607, it is the most prosaic of arrangements between a talented Mughal prince and the most promising Persian family at Jahangir's court. The bride is the daughter of Abu al-Hasan Yamin al-Dullah and the niece of Mer-un-Nisa, soon to become Nur Jahan. She is also the granddaughter of Ghiyas Beg, who is now celebrated as the Itmad-ud-Dullah, pillar of the government. This alliance solders the cause of a talented, hardworking, and ambitious family of impeccable Persian lineage to the Mughal throne, and romance is an irrelevant notion. And yet, this marriage will give rise to the most impertinent assessments of this celebrated union, tethered by the building of the most expensive and glorious monument to love the world has ever seen, the Taj Mahal. But how do we go and get there? How do we go from these two people getting together?
These two teens getting together.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be a political marriage, ended up being very much a love match. Here's the thing, Shah Jahan, he was the one who emerged victorious in the power struggle that developed after Jahangir's death and assumed the Mughal throne in 1628. His 30-year reign is dominated by an outward sense of propriety, stability, unmatched even during Akbar's rule. At the same time, almost every aspect of courtly culture became increasingly formalized. Shah Jahan was portrayed as an aloof, ideal king. Official histories thus present him as a just leader and a staunch upholder of orthodox Islam, but they gave little insight into the emperor's personal thoughts. Yet, Shah Jahan's unreserved preference for Dara Sukoh, his eldest son, an eclectic mystic thinker, suggests other aspects of this ruler's character never alluded to in court histories. The painted image of Shah Jahan parallels the literary one. The emperor is portrayed in an idealized manner. While he ages over time, his features remain flawless. His inner character is never revealed. Rather, his role is semi-divine king of the world. A play on his name is the focus of each portrait. His face is always surrounded by a halo, as in the late representation of Jahangir. In some of these illustrations, the metaphoric nature of the king's semi-divine and just quality is taken so far as to show small angels above his head, often crowning him, while at his feet are the lion and the lamb of peace. Here's the thing about him, is that he was the third son. There was always squabbling over who was actually going to be in charge. But once he took charge, he was very conscientious of the image that he was portraying. So we can view his rise as a mark of Jahangir's effort to shift the Mughals towards a system of quasi-designated succession. Between 1607 and 1621, the prince received every conceivable honor. None perhaps is more important than the open acknowledgement that he was the emperor's preferred choice to succeed the throne. Enabling his rise were his high-profile military appointments and military successes throughout the 1610s. Jahangir himself never led military campaigns as emperor, preferring that Karam, so that was his name when he was still a prince, and others do so in his stead. Karam also enjoyed a close alliance with his influential stepmother, Nur Jahan, who had married Jahangir in 1611. Karam took Nur Jahan's niece, Arjuman Banu Begum, better known as Mutez Mahal, in marriage in 1612. And from that point on, with one notable exception, 1619, she was the only woman to have children with him. So, like, here's the thing with Jahanara's father. He was the third son, but he was also the favored son. Everyone liked him. He was
the golden boy.
He was. And for very good reasons, too. It wasn't like, oh, like, we really like him, but he's incompetent. He was very competent. He really did cast this long shadow within her life, but not as much as her mom. But in contrast to her father, who, even though he is a bit of a mystery who he was as a person, we know of him. We know what he did. We knew who he was, all of that.
He's a perfect example of how, if you know how to craft a very solid public image, that becomes your epitaph and everything about you. Mm-hmm. And that, even if it's that question mark of, but who was he really as a person? He's kind of like Oprah. You have this impression of Oprah, but does anyone really know Oprah?
Whereas Matez is definitely, we don't know fuck all about Stedman. As Ira Makoti notes, in the case of Nur Jahan's niece, Mutez Mahal, the personality of the living, breathing human woman has been hopelessly subsumed by the great obsessive love she is supposed to have inspired in Shah Jahan, culminating in the building of the Taj Mahal.
I'm sorry, but I'm just imagining Oprah and then Stedman dying and then her building the Taj Mahal.
I mean, she probably will.
I mean, yeah, but that's the point, to your point of being, and what this author is saying is that for someone who we know donut about,
yeah,
there's a lot of conjecture being put about this person where it's, look at the beauty that's built because of them.
And of all the Mongol women in this book, Mutez Mahal is the most elusive. Hidden behind the excesses of her children, the humanist, glorious legacy of her husband, and the flawless perfection of the greatest monument to love ever built, Mutez Mahal's memory is wrought by the ambition of her children and husband, and the living woman is lost. I just kind of want to have like a bit of a mini rant, because I went and I read and went through about 6 books, possibly. I did control F for all of them. I learned F all about this woman.
Yeah.
Truly nothing.
The only thing we know about her was she was, even from this diary, is that she was pregnant.
All the time.
All the time. It was because her husband was in love with her and obsessed with her that he had to get her pregnant 14 times, even though she kept putting herself in danger and kept losing children, and it was probably very traumatic, and he's hauling her butt all over the place on elephants. And I'm just thinking, wouldn't have that been a better narrative if, instead of being, oh, my dad loves my mom so much, it was the question of, how much love love is too much love.
Also, is it really loving somebody in this way? I don't know.
Or just questioning it. Hey, I know you're pregnant for the 14th time, and the last 7 times have not ended well.
Or some of them have, but yeah, I get your point.
You know what I mean? Can we talk about that? What does it mean?
Shout out to our girl Sondok, because we do go and have a very accurate portrait, but still, let's add some questioning in here.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's no questioning happening in this book.
It's just sort of going with the flow. So you don't know anything about her mom, really.
We don't know that much about her. Here's the thing, is that he loved her. He did go and rely on her quite a bit. She had access to the Imperial Seal, which was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But she is somebody who, even more so than her children, is defined by just her relationships with other people. We don't know anything about her. She left no legacy outside of what other people did to memorialize her.
That's so-
yeah.
Kind of like Diana.
Yeah. And upon her death in 1631, Shahanara, who was age 17, she took the place of her mother as First Lady of the Empire, the Pradesh Begum, despite her father having 3 other wives. This made her in charge of the Zena, which was the royal household writ large, and it saw a massive increase in her influence to the point that, like her mother before, she had access to the Emperor's Seal.
Okay.
Jahanara's parents, fundamentally, they are mysteries. We know a bit about who they were. We know somewhat about what they did. And we can see some of their influences within their daughter. But fundamentally, aside from her being the favored daughter, what she thought about them, who they were as people, we don't know.
What their relationship with her was like.
Nothing.
Apart from, clearly they knew about her and they cared about her enough that she wasn't just punted off to the side, a la Elizabeth with Henry VIII punting her to Hatfield
all the time.
But there is that big question of, who is this girl to these people?
Yeah.
Who are these people to each other?
I always have a soft spot for moms in books, but I just feel so bad for her mom.
At least they tried to make her be a person in this book.
Yeah.
And give her a role, and she did showcase how just because you're not the person in charge doesn't mean you can't have influence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something positive out of it, but yeah.
Yeah.
In general, the real historical figure, poor lady.
Yeah.
Wamp, wamp.
Shall we spin?
Spin that wheel. Spin that wheel.
Architecture.
Yes.
One of the most enduring parts of Jahanara, but also her family and their dynasty's legacy, is in the architecture.
Yes.
There are more books written about Mughal architecture than there are books about her as a person. There is not a single volume study of Jahanara as a person. That is a thing that is noted in all of the books I read.
That's really bad. I could write about this person, but I'm going to write another book about this temple instead.
Yeah. But the thing is that fundamentally, we cannot underwrite the importance of architecture in general, but especially in the Mughal Empire. Catherine Asher, whose book I'm going to be drawing quite a bit from, in this section argues that the evolution of Imperial Mughal architecture, taste, and idiom was directly related to political and cultural ideology. This is the case in the planting of an ordered and regular garden, symbolic of paradise, and the building of state mosque, to the construction of an entire planned city, indicative of the empire's role as father to his people. Starting with Babur, architecture became a way of blending Persian and Muslim influences with the already established architectural style within the Indian subcontinent. Further, Akbar loved everything beautiful, and his love of architecture saw the building of many of the more iconic buildings in India from that time period. Agra's Red Fort, Humayun's Tomb, Fatehpur Sikri, a planned city that was supposed to be the capital, but he had to abandon the construction due to conflicts. Either we're going to go and build a city, or we're going to go and fight off the people who are trying to take us over.
Oh, so, man, I wish he had built a city.
He built quite a bit of it, though.
Good.
So you can still go and see it. And the tomb of Selim Christi, a significant religious figure. His successor, Jahangir, similarly completed several large projects, but none were as ambitious as Shah Jahan. Best known for his construction of the Taj Mahal, Shah Jahan was the greatest patron of Mughal architecture. The sums expended on his tombs, palaces, hunting pavilions and gardens, and entire planned cities is extraordinary even by modern standards. Just as the literary and painted image of Shah Jahan became increasingly ceremonial and formal, so his architecture, much of it meant to serve as an imperial setting, assumed an air of formality unprecedented in earlier Mughal structures. The use of white marble inlaid with stones, noted during the later portion of Jahangir's reign, characterizes much of Shah Jahan's architectural production. His buildings appear increasingly refined, establishing a style that became an Indian classic. In contrast to his predecessors, Shah Jahan was interested in lighter, airier, more ornate buildings. He tore out pretty much everything within the Agra Fort and had everything remade in white marble with new column styles, higher domes, and even more inlays. He recognized, too, that he could use architecture in creating his own sort of iconography. For example, the central pavilion in the platform that was his sleeping quarters, known today as the Khas Mahal, but in contemporary texts as the Aramgah, or place of rest, was flanked on either side by two almost identical rectangular pavilions within screened enclosures. From the north one, Shah Jahan presented himself to the public outside the fort on the terrain below. This pavilion was surrounded by curved sloping eaves and a bungalow roof that was gilded. Shah Jahan's official chronicler, Lahuri, notes that when the emperor presented himself to his subjects under this gilt roof, it appeared as if there were two suns. One was light from the morning sun reflected on the roof of this pavilion. The other, he remarks, was the emperor himself. Light reflected from the gold roof appeared to crown the king with a halo of a sort, often depicted in contemporary paintings and described in literature.
So this guy really was about image making.
100%.
So I do appreciate, though, the beauty of the architecture, or at least talking about it, where she's designing her own little sleeping area with what kind of stones do you want and blah, blah, blah. And it's just beautiful to imagine, but I can't, if you were to see it in real life, you'd probably just be blown away by it.
Two things. One, that does remind me about how she has daffodils sewn into one of her pants, and daffodils are my favorite flowers.
I noticed that. Julia would love a pair of those jeweled daffodil pants.
I would love a pair of jeweled daffodil pants. But number two, I mean, that was one of the things where, not to go and flex, but when we were in Granada and we got to go to the Alhambra, we went to the Great Mosque of Cordoba, and we got to go and see all the Muslim architecture that is still there, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, that is low scale. Oh, we just went and we recycled a bunch of stuff. If this is you recycling.
Yeah, can you imagine when they're trying from scratch? But I think that's something too, that sort of tight constrained box of, if I can't show images, but I can show depictions of script and words and a bunch of other things.
Mm.
It's almost like how Vine was only 6 seconds long. And in that 6 seconds, you were really creative. And so there's real creativity that shows up here.
But the point is, though, what does all this talk about architecture have to do with Jahanara, though?
Mm.
So as early as 637, Shah Jahan expressed his dissatisfaction with Agra's terrain. So he's torn out the Red Fort. He's been doing all this type of work.
Makeover, 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 makeover. Makeover.
And he expresses dissatisfaction, hence with its suitability with the imperial capital. Nevertheless, he and his favorite daughter, Jahanara, tried to improve the city. So they collaborated together. During this time, she also advocated for a new mosque to be built according to designs that they had worked on together. Jahanara's interest in architecture and her ability to contribute was not a new phenomenon, though, within the empire. Nur Jahan, so her maternal great aunt?
Yes.
She had an impressive architectural output during Jahangir's reign, and that might have motivated the leading ladies of Shah Jahan's court to endow many of the major buildings within the cities. And the foremost was Jahanara. Although not an architectural patron of Nur Jahan's innovative stature, Jahanara provided many notable buildings. Among these were the Jamik Mosque in Agra, and her Saray and garden, known as the Sahib Babad, which were discussed early in their urban context. But these, however, were not the only buildings that she constructed. Deeply religious, Jahanara wrote a biography of the Krishi saint Mukh and al-Din, and reputedly gave large sums to his Dogra and Amjamir. She also added the white marble pillared porch before the entrance of his tomb in the same place. Today it is known as the Begumi Dalan, derived from her name, Begum Sahib. Shahanara's devotion to the saints of the Krishi order is well known and even recorded on her simple white marble tombstone, situated approximately to Nizam al-Din's own tomb in Delhi. Less well known is her admiration of Mullah Sah Bakhtakshi of the Qadiri order and her subsequent initiation into the order. The princess built a mosque for the mullah and spacious dwellings for the poor beneath Akbar Srinagar's fort on the Hari Parbat Hill. Shahanara had an incredible amount of personal wealth that she spent as a patron to villagers, artists, in completing these building projects, along with these mosques and the additional spaces for the poor to go and reside without impunity, were several luxurious gardens, both for pleasure but also for deep reflection. While we have little of her own personal writings, who she was as a person, her values, her beliefs, and her influences are clearly carved out for all to see within her buildings.
Yeah, so she cared about it, taking care of the poor, letting the poor have a nice place to be, communal spaces. She cared about green spaces. She cared about religious spaces. Mm-hmm. So clearly these are things that she is of value. But that's the other thing too. That's sort of following in the line of how many royal women they're patronizing of different arts and cultural things. That is a form of self-expression where they might not have a law or a decree put out, but they're deciding, this is the kind of outfit I want to wear, or this is the type of building I want to make, or this is the type of food we're going to eat. That has such huge impact that actually, in my estimation, we probably feel the ripples of more so than some stupid dude man's random law that was overturned 100 years after, or the next reign later.
Yeah, truly, like when I said, like she had an incredible amount of personal wealth. You know how her mom got so much money? Well, her mom didn't spend all of that money. And when she died, Shahanara got half of her mom's wealth, and then the rest was divided up amongst the rest of her siblings.
I just can't get over how they give each other precious jewels. I think I'm just gonna get a beautiful semi-flawed pearl, or I think I'm just gonna get a giant emerald. And I'm just thinking, where do you get this from?
Rich people live in a way that we do not live in.
I would like to go to the emerald store.
The whole point is, though, Shahanara is participating in a larger legacy within her family. When we go and we think of the Mughal Empire, quite often it is less about, to your point, the laws that they wrote or the food that they ate or the places where they expanded to. It's in the buildings that they left behind. Mm. With a growing sense of taste, which was an amalgamation of both what was at that point the contemporary Indian architectural style, the Islamic and Persian influences they brought, they went and they created a style that was uniquely their own. Shahanara's contributions cannot be underwritten. The gleaming domes of the mosque that she went and she had constructed, the pleasure gardens that people still walk through today, cannot go and be understated. And that even though we cannot really go and know who she was as a person, we indelibly go and understand her presence whenever we are able to go and witness these spaces. I just want to say that I wrote that and I think that was beautiful.
Get out of here.
Spin that wheel. Religion.
Ooh.
Kind of perfectly working off of, because we just talked about her building a mosque. Sunni Islam was the official religion for the majority of the empire. At least when I say the majority of the empire, I mean what the official religion was. There were Hindus, there were Sikhs, there were Christians, there were Buddhists. You name them, someone was there. But the Din-i-Ilahi, known during its time as the Tawhid-i-Ilahi, the divine monotheism, literally oneness of God, or divine faith, was a syncretic religion or spiritual leadership program promoted by the Mughal Empire Akbar, which he launched in 1582, which was intending to merge some of the elements of the religions of his empire. His aim was to reconcile the differences that divide his subjects. The elements were primarily drawn from Islam, Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, but some others were also taken from Christianity, Jainism, and Buddhism. After Akbar's death, the movement fell out of favor. Dara, as we know, her younger brother in the book, he tried to revive the practice, but we all know how his attempt really went.
Was this sort of like that coexist bumper sticker?
It wasn't even just like a coexist bumper sticker. So here's the thing. There are like two ways of looking at it, and there's a bit of a divide where it's okay, how far did he mean to go and take it in terms of Akbar? Did he really mean in the way how the Romans were like, you can worship your Egyptian gods, and we're going to take elements elements of the Greek gods and elements of this god. We're all just going to be a big, happy family, right?
Yeah, as long as you pay your taxes, we don't really care.
Was it like coexisting of multiple faiths?
Amalgamation.
Yeah, an amalgamation type of thing. Or was it more of a, okay, fam, we all fundamentally want to be good, decent people. Let's just coexist.
Okay.
Was it that one? Was it this one? Was it somewhere in between? Depends on who you're talking to.
Well, and I'm sure it depends on whether or not that was perceived as a good or bad thing. Mm-hmm. Depends on whose side you're on. Because if you are in one of those minority religions, you're thinking, yes, coexist, bumper sticker, I'm for it. But if you're in the majority, why are we having to coexist?
Yeah.
This sucks. We're the majority. Let's just
be in charge. But here's the thing. Akbar's own religious movement was not the only thing that he was invested in. The Timurids of Central Asia long had a connection with the Sufi sheikhs of Islam, especially the Naqshbandi Silsila. The rulers courted the saints as a means to sanctify their claims to kingship, and in turn, the Sufis got the protection and patronage of the rulers, a mutually beneficial relationship. For the Mughals in Hindustan, the Sufis was yet another irrefutable way to justify their imperial claims, which basically was one of the Sufi mystics went and predicted the birth of one of Akbar's children. Clearly, we are down together.
Yes.
And it was like that type of deal. This is going to go and happen. You're going to be super great. And then, oh my God, I'm super great. Clearly we have favor. It's really easy to go and just reduce the Sufis. Like, they spin. They're super weird, you know? Yeah. They're not. Like, they were their own movement. They had their own specific things that they were trying to go and do. And be taken very seriously. It's kind of just...
it's richer than what you've been shown in the movie for the 5-minute song and dance number.
Exactly. But anyways, aside from that, under Shah Jahan, Islamic orthodoxy actually increased. For example, like Akbar and Jahangir, Shah Jahan often visited the tomb of Mukk in Al-Din, Krishti, and Ajmer. But unlike Akbar, who later abandoned the pilgrimage to Ajmer, and Jahangir, who never returned to the shrine once he left Ajmer as his residence, Shah Jahan paid homage to the saint at Ajmer until the end of his reign. Official histories indicate that the construction of Hindu temples was in some cases forbidden, and in a few earlier ones were actually dismantled, leading some to argue that Shah Jahan was intolerant of other religions. Even the percentage of high-ranking Hindu nobles decreased. Thus, Islam took on an importance as never before seen in Mughal India, although it is difficult to say whether Shah Jahan himself was more orthodox than his predecessors.
That does not come across in this book at all.
It does not. Her dad was a mixed bag, and that's okay. Okay, maybe it's not okay, but we can show that.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing to do that.
Yeah.
You don't have to make him be the perfect dad.
Exactly. But this trend towards orthodoxy obviously continued with his son, Aurangzeb, who, as portrayed in the book, was incredibly devout and held orthodox beliefs.
Who literally is one step away from being the CNN, your local terrorist.
I was about to go and say, talk to me about what he's like in this book, briefly.
So, in the book, what happens is her two younger brothers, Dara and Aurangzeb, are kidnapped and held hostage by the former empress, i.e. her maternal great-aunt.
Nur Jahan.
Nur Jahan. And
known as Nur Mahal in this book.
Yeah. And basically, both brothers are then returned to the family, but this is after a couple of years in basically kidnapped captivity. And Dara bounces back a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But the other brother, his response is clearly suffering from some sort of PTSD from the whole situation, but he's very guarded. And then he becomes increasingly religious and a little bit more fanatical about it.
Rigid.
But if anything, it almost seems like a trauma response to a situation outside of your control, especially as a child. If he were to have developed OCD and become very particular about, no, I have to do it certain way, because if I don't do it a certain way, bad things happen. That's the same sort of mentality that comes in with people who end up becoming hyper religious.
Yeah.
In my opinion, at least that's what I've seen. And it is one of those things where instead of it being a question of what else is going on here or blah, 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 she's just very, why is he such a stick in the mud? He's the worst.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of thinking he was being held captive by a person who I refer to as a snake. what's wrong with him?
I think someone wrote a rebuttal of, well, she's not that old. How is she supposed to know? Then as a writer, you're supposed to go and infer information for the reader that the character may not necessarily go and recognize. That's how writing works.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe she doesn't think to ask those questions to her brother or say, hey, how you doing? I noticed that things have been a little rough since you've come back into the fold. But I think as well, he just ends up becoming this very flat note, bitter proto-villain in the making.
Yeah.
Which, you know, then if you go on to read more about what happens in the family history, you just think, well, yeah, then he becomes the bad guy instead of wondering, but was he necessarily the bad guy? Mm-hmm. You know, in his mind, he probably wasn't. He was just doing what he needed to do to try to keep things in control.
Yeah.
And not let it spiral out.
We're gonna go and get more into him in the sibling section in terms of like how did he get into power.
Yeah, but her general reaction to him actually wanting to just observe things in their religion, which initially they don't seem that
religious.
They don't seem that religious or out of the ordinary. And then there's always that flex of, is it religion? Is it misogyny? Maybe it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blah.
Anyways.
Her brother, though, when he's in charge, he actually went and reestablished taxes on non-Muslims. He made Islamic jurisprudence the norm. Not that it wasn't already the norm, but it was more of a, instead of having like a little bit of wiggle room.
It was like, we follow Muslim law and Muslim courts.
Exactly.
Deal with it.
Yeah. And he took whatever opportunity he had to persecute and marginalize non-Muslims.
All right. So then he does turn into them.
Yeah. And he also was not a fan of Sufism, despite being taught within the tradition. The thing about her brother is that on one hand, he did a lot for the empire, but he also was a shit.
I feel like he's a very meat and potatoes kind of guy. What if we add a little bit of spice to this? He's, no!
Yeah. We're going to talk about a big irony with him in the sibling section, but he's very much somebody where it's a, he's just going to go blast ahead, do it exactly the way he wanted to go and happen. He had very firm ideas of how things were supposed to go and be.
So basically turn into like a hardline evangelical.
Pretty much.
Way
yeah.
to go.
Yeah. In terms of our girl, though, it seems that especially after her mother's death and then after Dara's execution, so her favorite brother, that she took a certain type of solace in Sufism itself. She went up to Kashmir and she spent 6 months in contemplation of the Qadiriya order under Mullah Shan Bakhtakshi. And Mullah Shah was an austere sheikh who had reached enlightenment through extreme breathing exercises, night vigils, fasts, and introspection. Jahara's relationship with Sufism was one of intense devotion, but also of personal growth and enlightenment. Her desire to go and uphold Sufism and to spread its impact manifested not just again in her building of a mosque, but also in her writing of significant figures in Sufism, including biographies of particular saints, along with her dedication and contemplation within her own life. One of the things that really bothers me about this book is that, like, to your point, she's seen as being like a Muslim cheester mm-hmm. when she wasn't.
Yeah.
And she wasn't in her own life because religion had a big influence on her whole family and the way how her environment was shaped.
Well, and I think especially with her pursuing her own personal path in her religious faith, that was a pretty dynamic component because to your point earlier, she couldn't rule. She wasn't allowed to get married and have children. So because of those things, it was what's something that she could nurture and grow and expand and reign, so to speak.
In herself,
her spiritual life.
Yeah.
Which does not come across here at all.
Exactly.
What a horrible missed opportunity. I could have learned about Sufism with this book.
Yeah. There are some people where it's like there's a big debate, like how devout was Marie Antoinette, for example. She was actually pretty devout in her Catholicism, but that's not considered to be like a major part of her
identity.
Yeah. But for Jahanara, it was. Of the few things that we know about this woman for sure, she loved her faith. It was very important to her. The final spin.
Final spin!
It literally is only one thing, but I really love the spinning animation.
Spin, spin, spin.
Oh, Jeez, it's the last category. I can't believe it. Siblings.
Oh, save the best for last. All the drama.
All the drama. Shahanara was one of 14 children, and she was the eldest surviving overall. Remember how we went through the list?
Yeah.
We're gonna go through the list.
Oh my god.
So, her Anisa Begum was the firstborn in 1613 and died in 1616. She died of smallpox. Shahanara, who was known as the Padshah Begum at this point, she was born on the 23rd of March, 1614, and she died on the 16th of September, 1681. And she was, of course, as we know, our heroine. She was the favorite and most influential daughter, and she was the first lady in the Mughal Empire after her mother's death, despite that her father had three other consorts. She died unmarried. Dara Shikoh. So he was born on March 20th, 1615. He was killed on the 30th of August, 1659.
Who killed him?
He was the eldest son and heir apparent. He was favored as a successor by his father, Shah Jahan, and his elder sister, Princess Jahanara Begum, but was defeated and later killed by his younger brother, Prince Mohideen, later Emperor Aurangzeb, in a bitter struggle for the imperial throne.
That's why you gotta kill those younger siblings, y'all.
Wow, thanks. He had married and he did have issue.
Yeah, he had issues, all right.
Shah Shuja, who was born on the 23rd of June, 1616, and he died on the 7th of February, 1661. He actually survived a war of succession, and he married and he had children. Roshanara Begum was born on the 3rd of September, 1617, and died on the 11th of September, 1671. She was the most influential of Shah Jahan's daughters after Shahanara Begum and sided with Aurangzeb during the war of succession. She died unmarried. She also made these amazing pleasure gardens, too, in North Delhi that I really want to go to one day. And then we have Aurangzeb, who was born on the 3rd of November. That bitch would be a Scorpio.
I was going to say, I felt Scorpio energy all the way.
I was like, I felt the energy of my people with him. 3rd of November, 1618, and he died on the 3rd of March, 1707. He succeeded his father as the 6th Mughal Emperor after emerging victorious in the War of Succession that took place after Shah Jahan's illness in 1657. He married and he had issue. Azad Bakhsh was born on 18th of December, 1619, and died in February or March of 1621, died in infancy. Soraya Banu Begum, born on the 10th of June, 1621, died on the 28th of April, 1628, died of smallpox. An unnamed son was born in 1622 and died soon after birth. Murad Bakhshish, born on the 8th of October, 1624, executed on the 14th of December, 1661. Per Aurangzeb's order, he had married and he had issue. Lufti Allah was born on the 4th of November, 1626, and died on the 13th of May, 1628. Died at the age of 1.5 years, reasons unknown. Dulat Afsa was born on the 8th of May, 1628, and died on the 13th of May, 1629. Died in infancy, we don't know why. And then Hus Ara Begum was born on the 23rd of April, 1630, died in 1631 at an unknown date for unknown causes. And then...
it's just getting sadder and sadder, man.
And then Guwahar Ara Begum was born on the 17th of June, 1631, died at an unknown date in 1706, and her mother died while giving birth to her. She died unmarried.
What was it, like 30 hours of labor or something?
It was insane numbers of labor. Here's the thing. She had a child in 1613, 1614, 1615, 1617, 18, 19, 21. So in the year 20, she had a freaking break. 22, she had a baby. Had another break because she didn't have another baby until 24. Another break in 25. And then 26, 28, 30, and 31. This poor woman. Also, I do think it's interesting how in the book, two things. Oh, my mom, like, lost the baby. Like, no, she gave birth to these children, but they kept on dying.
Yeah, that'd be a different situation as opposed to miscarriages, yeah, which are horrific in their own, but to carry a child full to term, give birth, it's a live child, and then to have it die.
Also, question, did you notice that someone was missing in this book from after hearing that list?
Julia, that was such a long list of the Benny Hill clown car. I have no idea.
Where is Shah? Shah is not in the book! And he survived the War of Succession.
That's true.
Help me, Shaw Rule. Where is Shaw?
Yeah, no, that's true.
That's the whole thing. The thing is, he's not in this book. He was older than Dara and older than Roshanara.
Does he show up as, like, the little three-year-old?
No, because that's her younger brother, Murad. The toddler shows up. You want to know why? Because they're like, I don't know what to do with him. Because he doesn't do anything. First of all, Shaw survived.
The fact that there's how many kids, he actually made it. How dare you cut out Shaw?
And also, he didn't get executed, unlike his other two brothers.
He survived.
That's, for me, the biggest irony, is that not only did he survive childhood, but he also survived the freaking coup.
But he didn't survive enough to be in this book.
Exactly.
Where is Shaw?
All right. Okay, but speaking of the coup.
Oh, yes.
In 1657, Shah Jahan became so ill that those around him believed that he had little time left to live. His four sons, Murad, Shah, Aurangzeb, and Dara Sukoh, the king's favored heir apparent, vied for the crown. This is not like a Shah stan account, but yet it is a bit, like, I feel like he needs to have a little bit of pep, you know, good for you, babe. Like,
yeah, yeah. It.
Each proclaimed himself emperor. For in the Turan tradition, succession was not based on primogeniture, but on cunning and strength. Shah Jahan.
Oh my God. What? It's like, I feel like I'm dying. Into the ring. Bong. They just fight each other.
I mean, low key, that is kind of what any squabble for succession is like.
Oh my God, it's so bad. I mean, yes and no, because it's better than, hey, I'm really qualified. I'm the smartest. I'm the best. You should pick me. You came out too late.
Yeah.
I'm picking the first and stupid one.
Anyways, Shah Jahan recovered fully within a month, but the War of Succession was already well underway.
can't put the starter pistol back in.
Exactly.
Like, and go, I take it back.
Exactly. But why did this happen? It was a combination of there was dissatisfaction with the succession plans and how Dar was treated compared to his brothers. Such favoritism brought enormous resentment amongst his other sons, especially as Shah Jahan aged throughout the 1650s. Dara Sukoh's influence grew even stronger to the great alarm of his brothers. In a 1657 letter to his older sister Jahanara, Aurangzeb angrily demanded why, quote, despite 20 years of service and loyalty, he is not considered worthy of the same level of confidence as his brother's son, i.e. Suleiman Sokoh. So Dara's son had more influence than the actual kid.
I'm imagining like scenes from Arrested Development right now.
I love all my children equally. I don't really care for Aurangzeb. Far from forestalling a destructive war of succession, Shah Jahan's actions, in fact, intensified the conflict between Dara and the rest of his sons.
Well, no shit.
Yeah. Despite Shah Jahan's efforts, his other sons were not content to accept either their father's plans for his succession or their older brother's presumptions to be next in line. But at one point, Jahanara apparently suggested that we actually just go and partition the empire. Dara would be given the Punjab and the adjoining territories. Shah would get Bengal. Murad would get Gujarat. And Aurangzeb's son, Sultan Muhammad, would get the Deccan. And the rest of the empire would go to Aurangzeb.
The rest would go to him. It's like, what's left? And there's a little bit over here.
Well, he would get all of Delhi, the central part, Kashmir. Like,
fair enough.
Yeah, he would get a decent amount. Either way, he refused his offer on the grounds that Dara was, in his mind, an infidel.
Mm.
Prince Aurangzeb emerged victorious, and to ensure his position, he had his brothers and their sons imprisoned or murdered. Proclaiming his father incompetent to rule, Aurangzeb declared himself Mughal Emperor in 1658.
All right, then.
Yeah. During this time, Jahanara had thrown her support behind her brother Dara, who was her favorite. She had written that, "He and I are one soul manifested in two forms, and we are one life in two bodies." Due to her supporting him and Aurangzeb being victorious, she lost her role as the Pradesh Begum to her sister Roshanara. And then on Aurangzeb's ascent to the throne, Jahanara joined her father in imprisonment at Agra Fort, where she devoted herself to his care until his death in 1666. She is forgiven by Aurangzeb after Shah Jahan's death.
Probably because he realized, oh shit, the person who is probably making all these things happen was her.
We're not exactly sure why he forgave her. Maybe he just saw her devotion to her faith or her building projects, that she never caused a fuss herself. She never really pushed back against him. She wasn't scheming behind his back. But in the end, fundamentally, we don't really know. It was about like an 8-year period where she was out of favor.
So she played nice for 8 years.
Yeah, and she was taking care of her dad, and she got to be left alone and could do whatever she wanted.
Which is peak in this time.
Yeah, because like she's technically not at court. She's outside of it. She can do whatever the frick she wants, as long as she doesn't cause trouble.
That's the peak place to be, let's be honest.
Yeah. Shahanar did go and regain her position as a significant cultural force and was once again the Empress of Princesses, replacing her sister. And she lived the rest of her life within Delhi, writing a biography of Krishi, and she died in 1681. So that was Jahanara and all the different things going around her and what shaped her.
That's a lot of stuff that I don't think came across in this book.
At all! When it comes to Jahanara, when I was reading about her, she didn't have as an egregious situation. Like with her mom, we know nothing about this woman aside from the children that she bore. Mm. Like we do have some information about her. But I think that she was in such an interesting time and location.
You know, we don't have a lot of direct information about Sondok's childhood, mm-hmm. but we are still able to make a very moving story and understanding about who she is as a person and that push-pull between honor and family and different religious influences and cultural influences.
The role of women.
All that stuff came through successfully, and this book could have done that.
But it didn't.
If anything, I'm like, where's the recipe book?
I know, right? I'm like, I just want to make the food. The hard thing about this book is that it is a lot of shiny veneer, but when you go, you push against it, it kind of just starts to crumble a bit.
Yeah. The exotic orientalism sort of doesn't do enough lifting.
Yeah. And Edward Said is like, told you.
And also, where was Shah?
Where was Shah? Help me, Shah Rule!
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.